This is Women's Voices and Women's Stories on Yin Radio. I'm Sandy Billings, and I'm bringing you a great eclectic collection from 2007 today. The first half of today's show comes from a Yin Radio show called Women's Intuition, and it's an exploration of women's learning styles with Professor Marty Yap. And then I'm going to go around town with people in Moscow to answer the question, do you trust your intuition? The second half of the show is kind of busy with four kind of short pieces, and they cover having babies or not having babies while all your friends are having them, and then a piece on activism and a commentary from a now-graduated columnist at the university, Washington State University's student paper, The Evergreen. And then we're going to end the show with wedding fashion, a story about a bridesmaid's dress. And you know how great that can really be. From KRFP in Moscow, Idaho, this is Yin Radio with a great eclectic collection from 2007. It's the best of season one. First, Professor Marty Yap talked to Yin Radio live from her office in Boise on January 25th, 2007. The show was called Women's Intuition. Marty talked with me about women's learning styles, and here's that interview. I have on the line with me Dr. Marty Yap, Dr. Martha C. Yap, she's known as Marty. She's a professor in the Department of Adult and Organizational Learning in the College of Education at the University of Idaho. She's a guest with me by phone. Let's do a little sound check and make sure we have Marty on the line. Hi, Marty.
Hi.
Excellent. Marty serves as the program coordinator of Adult and Organizational Learning in the College of Ed at UI. She's doing research and writing which focuses on mentoring, aging well in America, and using appreciative inquiry as a way to negotiate and do strategic planning. Dr. Yap's always been interested in women as adult learners, and that's what she's going to talk to us about today, at least primarily. She's conducted research on women returning to college as non-traditional learners, and learning styles is one of the topics that impacts on the success women have in academia and in the workplace. I'm real anxious and interested to explore that with her a bit today. Dr. Yap's been at the University of Idaho for 20 years, and 15 of those were here in Moscow. And only the last four has she been at the Boise Center. Her ED is from George Washington University in Washington, D.C., with a major in higher ed, and her support field in adult education and in human resource development. Thank you so much for being with us today, Marty.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Well, it's certainly my pleasure. And we talked a little bit in prior to this interview about women's ways of knowing. And can you just kind of start us off by telling us just some background? What do we know about how women learn as opposed to men? Why do we need to talk about women's ways of knowing?
Well, partly because in our effort to have equality and equal rights for everybody and equal pay for everybody, sometimes we try to put people into the same boxes, and we all really know, I think, if you just look at the fact that there are differences physically, emotionally, intellectually in men and women. That doesn't mean that one is better, that doesn't mean that one is worse, but if you really look at the research historically, even over probably 75 years, certainly 50, a lot of research has been done on the way that people learn, but it was based a lot on the way that men tend to learn. And some of the more recent research shows that women take their learning, as with a lot of other things, a little more personally, that they really try to connect their learning with other things that they're doing so that it's somewhat practical, but also that they can understand it better. And so women value learning that occurs in a more of a social relationship. They really value the friends that they make in their classrooms. They value their teachers. They value the mentors they have along the way. And they also feel that they learn from others in their community and in other activities in which they participate. And again, if you look a little bit historically of women throughout history, and I'm talking primarily of the United States or certainly the Western world, but that women learned in small groups, and you'd have groups of women who would, I don't want to really say sit around in a circle or whatever, but maybe, and they would They would teach each other how to cook. They would teach each other how to do handicrafts or knit, or they would also teach each other things about parenting skills and some basic nursing and taking care of their families and things. And they would learn from each other. I'm not necessarily always the old, younger learning from the older, but people, women with experience would teach other women. And so in some of the research that's been done, they really like a little more interactive learning, and they tend to enjoy cooperative learning and getting to know the people that are in their learning environment. And that's good, because there's a lot of very good learning that can go on in that model. It's just not necessarily the model that is used in most of higher education even today, and particularly in lower division core courses, that there's still a lot of lecture. There may be some discussion, but a lot of times it's large group, it's somewhat impersonal, and the book and theory are utilized more than learning in context. So women in higher education certainly are doing well, and there's more women in higher education undergraduate now than there are men, but this is not necessarily their preferred learning style, and but they can adapt to it, and lots of people can. But probably one of the other things that's a little concerning is that still highly competent girls and women tend to underestimate their abilities and report feeling somewhat inferior to others around them. And why this is true, and it's been some research done by the American Association of University Women, that was done probably 15 or 20 years ago, and other people have picked up on some of that, and still they find that young girls, junior high, high school, a lot of times feel that they are intellectually or scholastically inferior. And they don't necessarily say always to the boys or men in the class, but they just don't feel that they themselves are very scholarly, and they certainly don't feel that they are becoming an expert on anything. And so I think this is an attitudinal thing that we all need to work with in trying to increase the self-esteem and the feelings of being able to learn and be able to be successful for boys and girls, because there's some other research that shows that a lot of young boys now in public schools also feel kind of inadequate or inferior, but they express it a little differently.
So if we're in a learning system, the education system that has been designed by men for men and boys to learn using the styles that have historically worked for men and boys, that makes sense. I mean, because that's where the education system came from. And whether boys learn that way and or men learn one way and women learn another way because of social or cultural or biologic reasons, I don't know if we want to go there later, but the difference exists, and the system grew up for and by the guys, and so the women are coming into it, and we're beginning to know that. Maybe we've known it for a while that the styles are different. Are we seeing any changes in the system, or in little pockets of the system at least?
Well, I think so, and there's also not necessarily just the gender issue, although certainly it is a factor. But there are other learning styles that people have that might not relate to gender at all, that would relate to other aspects in terms of preferences, in terms of the types of activities that they feel good about. And so we're seeing research, and we're seeing a lot of books and things that are being written about more contextual learning, of having all students learn more in context, so that they're learning some theory, they're learning some background, some foundational material, and then hopefully have an opportunity to apply it. We're seeing a return at the high school level and in Idaho in certain places of the academy model, where students actually are able to kind of have a major in high school for their last couple of years, actually starting in their sophomore year. And in Napa, for example, I just happen to know a couple of the teachers that are involved in the Finance Academy. And so you've got some high school students, young men and women, boys and girls, who are actually choosing a finance major for their sophomore, junior, and senior year in high school, and they become a cohort group, and all of their teachers are also a cohort group, and it becomes very project-based, and in their English, and in their science, and in their history, and mathematics, they are looking at some business and finance materials as a way to earn their credits in those other ways, but there's more of a connection. Mm-hmm. I think that's one of the things between disciplines, regardless if it's men or women or if it's high school or adult education or higher education or beyond, is trying to make the connections so that what people are learning is relevant, and that throughout a day or a semester or whatever, a lot of what they're studying relates to other things that they're studying. And so you have... you kind of have a holistic approach to what they are studying, and so obviously they learn it from more than one direction, and hopefully they learn it with a lot more depth, and then they're able to transfer it more effectively into additional learning or to solving other problems.
I wonder if that approach, though, is slower. It's like, kind of like a hands-on approach. For everybody to figure things out from the beginning, it's kind of like it's just very slow, as opposed to if you can just have somebody brain dump it into you through a lecture, and that may not be the most flattering way to talk about a lecture, but that's very efficient if it works for you. And I hear, having worked with engineering schools quite a bit, and the curriculum is so packed and there's so much information to relay, that that's one reason engineering curricula is so loath to change drastically. I mean, you get a lab and you get to put your hands on, but otherwise it's cram as much information that's relevant to the subject in as quickly as possible. And, of course, that uses the older techniques, and it uses, of course, very analytical thinking because of the material, and it just so happens there are fewer women in there. Is there a relationship in all of that?
Well, I think with engineering, and again, it could be that it's more mathematical. Now, if we get, and I agree with what you say, and there is, but what we have to look at is, are we looking for, even at higher education, and certainly at public school, but higher education, are we looking at educating the very elite, or are we looking at a model that is going to provide meaningful higher education to a much larger percentage of the population? And I think you're going to see that you're going to have some different models, that every model isn't going to work the same for everybody. Now, people, if we get into just, again, the biology of just women tend to be more right-brained and men tend to be more left-brained, and the left brain promotes more logical, sequential, theoretical, rational, analytical, objective, and if you look at the theory on parts of breaking things down into individual parts and analyzing them and then at that point trying to somehow put them all back together. And the development of the right side of the brain promotes thinking as a little more random and intuitive, which is, I know, part of the intuition, which tends to be a little more prevalent with women, holistic versus breaking things down into parts, kind of trying to synthesize and look for patterns, look for ways that things naturally kind of fit together. So, again, one's not bad and one's not good, and if we just look at engineering and the people that go in and meet the entry requirements for engineering, a lot of them probably do have learning preferences that that align more with the scientific model rather than a more developmental model or a more holistic model of looking at the kind of the big picture of things. And So I think, you know, higher education, education at all levels, but, and as things change so rapidly, there's a need for people to have more continuing lifelong learning, and that it's not enough to graduate and get your degree and even to go out and work and learn in the field, that things, technology as well as so many other dimensions of society and commerce and business and the way we live and the way we interact with other people, the dynamics as far as aging, the baby boomers, there's just so many things going on that we really need to look at education as being way beyond K through 12 and way beyond just undergraduate and maybe even a master's program. We need to look at opportunities for education and learning and continuing development to go on all through adulthood. And certainly now we're even going to be looking at productive ways to educate people to have better lives and to age well as more and more of them are living longer and longer. So I think we're going to have to really look at the learning style needs of the population as a whole, and that and there are, there's a lot of very, very good continuing education and professional development that goes on for adults that is maybe a little more nurturing and contextual.
I'm personally glad to hear that, because I think about my own learning experience, and maybe many people listening feel the same thing, that we probably everybody feels like they missed a little bit and wish we had a little bit different, because we're not all the same. And I do think that I hope that we all realize that in talking about men's tendencies and women's tendencies, we're only talking tendencies and generalities. To be human is the broad spectrum of thinking styles, of learning styles, et cetera, et cetera. But in order to talk about it, we got to talk about generalities and tendencies. I just hear a lot of my styles and my preferences and how much I appreciate at work and in learning the relationship and the intuitive and the kind of holistic thinking. So it's really encouraging to know that educators are aware of this, and I'm guessing that most people who are actually educating on the ground, whether they're working in the field of education or some other field, are probably more and more aware of these differences in learning styles and trying to cater to them. Is that a fair assessment, do you think?
I would say that there's a lot more attention and a lot of literature that is being addressed to learning styles, and then also looking at temperament and preferences, and that that people, men and women, tend to come to the table, if you will, and if it's the education table, but also the career table, with certain things that they enjoy doing that they tend to do well, and then unfortunately most of us have a few little weaker areas. Now, one thing is trying to make everybody more holistic, and so trying to make sure that that both men and women have more opportunities in academia or in their career to do more holistic things and to think on both sides of the brain and everything. But then you also realize that we need some people that are way at the other spectrum in order to do very specialized jobs that are, you know, so we really have a need for some people that are just so left brain that they can do some specialized jobs that you don't need the general public to be able to do, but you do need some experts, you need some people. So we really need people all the way across the continuum. And I guess the one thing we shouldn't do is to stereotype and say, oh, well, she's a girl, so she doesn't do math. We should, hey, let's try to find a way to connect math in with learning styles and maybe a presentation, or maybe the examples are something that they're a little more interested in, so that we don't just say, well, we're not going to compensate for the fact that that girls don't do math. We need to figure out ways that we can make girls like math better. And the same thing in terms of some of the language arts and communication skills and some of the arts and that boys tend to shy away from. Again, let's try to think creatively and look at computer models and all sorts of ways that people can learn now. And, you know, the computer is a whole new variable. And the one thing we want to try to do, because so many people have access to it, but a lot of times they're going to gravitate towards things that they prefer. And so we just have to try now to make sure that there are good educational materials that people can use in their lifelong learning as well as in their more formative years that are going to enhance and broaden all of our abilities to do things and to understand them and to learn new things in creative ways. So that's kind of exciting, but then the challenges in terms of designing that software and disseminating it and all of those things, because we all know that there's also some things out there on the computers that may not be the best the best learning tools and may not be good for socialization and a lot of other things. But a lot is being written, research is being done on preferences, and I guess one thing is that we need to appreciate all of us for our innate abilities, and we need to a certain extent try to capitalize on those things that we do enjoy and do well, but then we need to figure out ways to try to help people become at least minimally competent and informed in some other areas, not that they just say, well, I don't do math, or that we try to figure out ways that we can broaden people in healthy directions. And so
perhaps one message is one size does not fit all.
That's true.
And
that's
maybe
exactly true.
Maybe another message we all as learners might take away from this is that we can value our learning style and recognize that this one way, if we feel like we're just getting one approach and it's not working for us, we can look for others.
And the other thing, if we understand a little bit about learning styles and preferences just as people, and when we're working with other people or in cooperative learning or teams or whatever, whether at workplace, even in social clubs or church or other activities, that we can appreciate other people for their learning style and preference and understand that in a lot of cases they might balance ours, and the result would be a stronger team, because you would just have a broader threshold of ideas, and if that can open up healthy brainstorming and conversation and come up with better solutions to complex problems, then that can be very healthy. And so as people are more aware of the fact that other people don't all think and learn and have preferences that they do, but you learn to appreciate the strength that those people bring to the table, then in group dynamics that can be real powerful.
Thank you so much, Dr. Marty Yop, for talking with me today. This has been an insightful and a great kickoff to our show on learning styles.
Well, thank you for inviting me, and I enjoyed it, and I hope to talk with you again.
Good, thank you.
All right.
Dr. Marty Yop is professor of education at the University of Idaho in Boise. She's the program coordinator for the Adult and Organizational Learning Department there. And she studies women as adult learners and has conducted research on women returning to college as non-traditional learners. She joined me by phone from her office in Boise today. For that same show that came from January 25th, 2007. The show was called Women's Intuition. I had also gone around town and asked people in Moscow, Idaho, do you trust your intuition?
Mm-hmm. Do you trust your intuition?
Definitely.
Do you trust your intuition?
Yes. Intuition as in my gut feeling. I definitely do. I think it's really important to go with what your body and your heart is telling you. And that's something I almost live by, is going by what you feel inside.
Do you trust your intuition?
I do my best to trust my intuition, and it's served me pretty well.
For the next show, do you trust your intuition?
Yes.
That was easy.
Why wouldn't I?
Yeah. As an artist.
Good point.
You didn't record.
Okay.
Do you trust your intuition?
I do.
Usually that's all the answer I get.
Oh, you want more?
No. If you have more to say.
Oh, okay. All right. Do you trust your women's intuition?
Yeah. Yes, I do. But I can't think of a particular example when the last time I had was. What I intuited when I was intuitive about something. I'm trying to think. I think if I had a really serious decision to make, I would try to be factual about it. But if I didn't have if that didn't persuade me one way or the other, and I was sitting on the fence, I would go with my intuition. Yeah, I would.
Is that similar to your gut feeling?
Yeah, I think so. Yes. The only other thing, way that I think it could be different is that a lot of times when I need to find where I need to go and I don't know the real, and I'm talking physical way to go from one point A to point B, and I don't know the real way to get there, maybe in an unfamiliar city, then I sort of am intuitive about the way to get there. That may be a different form of intuition. I'm not sure.
That's Intuition from January 25th, 2007 on Yin Radio, the best of Season 1. Now, moving on to July 12th, 2007, the show was on the theme of having babies and not having babies. Yin Radio's first intern, Brittany Perrault, had just graduated from Washington State University. With her new degree in communications, she had just gone back home to Seattle to seek the job of her dreams. Many of her old friends had taken another route, though. Since high school, some of them had been having babies. In this next installment, Brittany shares her thoughts about having babies early in life as she heads out to start her career.
It used to be the norm to get married at a young age, start a family soon after. But this is what was appropriate for the times. It was normal for a woman to feel in a hurry to get married if she wasn't married by age 20 in the early to mid-1900s. That is not the case today. More and more couples are waiting to get married. More women are getting educations and wanting to start a career and have financial stability before they start a life with their partners. This is looked at as the smart route to go. So why is it that I know so many people that are getting married and having children when none of them are over the age of 23? Are we resorting back to this early 1900s idea? I can count on both hands and even have to resort to some toes as to how many people have kids that I went to high school with. And of those, about 5 or so are my close friends. Some of them are married, some of them are not. When my best friend of 10 years asked me to be her maid of honor in her wedding, it was a very special thing to be a part of. But when we were in the middle of planning her July wedding, and she called me in November asking when I was coming back for winter break, I knew what was going on. She was pregnant and was moving the wedding date up to December. This was exciting news because this was the first of my friends to get pregnant, and for it to be my best friend made it so much fun to be a part of. We got to plan a wedding, and in about a month, we got to look forward to her pregnancy and the arrival of her first child. I missed a lot of the pregnancy because I was away at school, so I saw her at 2 and 3 months, then briefly around 6 months, and then at her baby shower when she was ready to pop at like 8 or 9 months. Before her and her husband found out the sex of the baby, It was the girls' names that they couldn't decide on. They knew that if it was a boy, they wanted to name him Dylan. The night before she was going to find out, I had a dream that it was going to be a boy. And sure enough, that day, when she got back from the doctor and called me, they were going to have baby Dylan Andrew Ray. Dylan, who I nicknamed Dilly, was due in June, and we were all anxious for his arrival. I really was, because I felt like I missed so much, and to miss the birth would just really upset me. Every time I saw Jenna, I would talk to Dilly in her belly and tell him he had to wait for me to be in town. But Dylan blessed us with his presence on June 7th, 2006, and they were a little relieved because they didn't want his birthday to end up being 6606. I didn't get to be there because I was planning on coming to town just 2 days later, so I saw her the first day of being home. Jenna and her husband asked me to be Dylan's godmother, and I felt even more honored than I was when I was asked to be her maid of honor. This is a life that I'll be connected to forever, bound by God. The only other downfall was, yet again, me being here at WSU made it so I even missed my own godson's baptism. Although I missed the ceremony, I still signed the papers, and it's official, and that still means a lot to me. Since Dylan's birth, two of my other friends became pregnant. It must be some sort of trickling effect. One friend gets engaged, one friend has a baby, and then another. And then before I know it, by the time I move back home after graduating college, I have two more friends with babies, another getting married in July, and another that's engaged. I'm just shy of 22 years old, and I feel like I'm behind in the commitment area, even though I've been with my boyfriend longer than any of my friends getting married or who are already married. I keep telling my friends they need to stop having babies, or else by the time I have a child, mine won't have anybody their age to play with. Or they're just going to have to get pregnant as soon as I am. It's just such a reality that I'm growing up. I've been in college for the last 4 years, and when I go back home in 4 days, things are going to be different. My friends have husbands and fiancés and children and full-time jobs, and here I am, in a sense, just starting my post-grad life. It'll be an interesting journey. So much has happened in the past 4 years. I can only imagine what's still left to come in the next four.
That last clip came from Brittany Perrault. She was an intern at Yin Radio in the spring of 2007. Now, during her internship, Brittany recorded fellow WSU student Brielle Schaefer. Brielle wrote a regular feminist column for the Daily Evergreen newspaper. So here is Brittany's recording of Brielle Schaefer reading a column that she had published in 2006 about the fashion industry.
I never read beauty or fashion magazines. Usually I would rather read independent magazines or weekly news magazines that shorten the wait in doctor's offices. But the other day I bought a Vogue. The cover was so glossy and charming, with a pretty actress in a provocative pose, her sweater hanging jauntily off the shoulder. Something else also caught my eye in the cover in the magazine. On the left side was copy that read, "I'm worth it." And you know what I thought to myself? I am worth it. I am worth the $3.99 plus tax to feel singled out by the large, mass-marketed magazine. The closest I've gotten to Vogue in many years, besides knowing of its sheer existence, was my recreational read of The Devil Wears Prada this year and its cute humanization of the fashion world. I leafed through the first 40 pages of advertisements for fancy designers like Prada, Oscar de la Renta, and Gucci, interspersed with makeup advertisements telling us how to be more beautiful. The pictures of the models were all perfect. They had perfectly coiffed, long legs, and were flawlessly made up with the modern emotionless model face, their lips slightly parted. I finally got to the editor's note. It was articulate and enthralling. Anna Wintour, the editor of Vogue, wrote about a recent New York Times business section article that examined the power of women as consumers making their own large purchase decisions, like buying houses and going on vacations. She also touched on how women's values are dominating typically male sectors. The note went on to say that this was not new at Vogue, but this issue is a celebration of women leading their own professional and economic lives. However, immediately following this statement, she credited two males, a fashion editor and a photographer, as the creative geniuses behind the fashion spread that was going to be the pinnacle of the celebration. This news was simultaneously thrilling and upsetting. Here was Vogue, the trendy magazine for modern women, telling me that I'm worth it, that I can take charge of my future, even alone if I wanted to. However, only under the framework of men. In a way, it is a funny metaphor for reality. Women are continually defined in relation to men. This magazine is advocating that women finally and openly take complete control of their economic lives, but only under the direction of men. Maybe these men were the best for the job and are able to identify with a female cause, but according to the aforementioned New York Times article, many men cannot. For example, a man who made manufactured homes in Canada had to change his entire design once he sought feedback from women. In his blueprints, the kitchens were too small, and the laundry room-mudroom combination was not a popular choice. Citing this example indicates that the majority of men probably do not think the same as women or share the same values. I must admit, I was surprised to see this point being made in Vogue. Wintour is a strong woman who had the drive to get a powerful magazine editing position. The supposedly fictional depiction of her in The Devil Wears Prada shows her as a heartless bitch, the stereotypical description of a no-nonsense woman. Suddenly, women are dominating a few sectors of society, but instead of reveling in the purchase power and academic prowess, some women are pussyfooting around any decisions that show they are dominating. Printing this issue, Vogue isn't going to offend its target audience, but in practice, it isn't implementing its own message. It's okay for a moment while reading this magazine to think that you are worth it, but the moment you realize the whole magazine is supporting the male-dominated infrastructure of our society, the illusion ends. Instead of helping fellow women work their way up the corporate ladder by showing a little female solidarity, like Wintour could have done when hiring women for the I'm Worth It issue, fashion designer, and photographer, women are having all the ideas and giving all the credit to men. It's a submissive battle.
That's from Brielle Schaefer. She wrote that column for the Daily Evergreen, WSU's student newspaper. Just weeks before Brielle and Brittany, her interviewer, had both graduated from WSU, the two women got together at the radio station on campus. They talked about Brielle's passions, her views, her interests and goals, and Brielle's women's music radio show.
All right, I am here with Brielle Schaefer, and I'm going to ask her a couple questions about something that she feels the most concern about within women's issues, is something that she has the most passion about.
I feel most passionate about equal rights for men and women, and I mean in all spectrums, probably pay equity and equal rights over their respective bodies. And so I guess that encompasses a lot, but it would be really great if we could get an equal rights amendment passed in our nation. I would really like that, and that's what I feel like I'm most passionate about right now.
Are you doing anything to help the equal rights at all, or is it just something that you're just really interested in, or something that you would like to, you personally, try to make a difference in?
I really want to become a professional activist, so I'm taking steps to keep trying to, help the movement, the women's movement. But currently, I'm a feminist in my everyday life, and I feel like just living that makes a big statement. And by writing opinion columns on women's issues, I feel like I can get my voice heard. And if I can change one person's mind on thinking differently about women's rights and our equal rights, I think I'm doing a good job.
Definitely. What do you feel about women's representation or misrepresentation in higher positions within radio or media, even in general?
That's a great question, actually. I think that there just aren't enough women in the media or at the forefront of the media. Yes, we're hearing all these statistics and news articles of how women are beginning to approach men in the workplace in academic spectrums, but it's really not
that true because we don't see it. And women aren't approaching men in pay or just like equal coverage. And that's just really kind of upsetting, especially with female artists in the music industry. Yes, there's a lot of female artists, but male artists are dominating. They get the most of the play. And then if there is a female artist, she's a novelty. And that's just really discouraging. And there needs to be kind of a move away from the gendered and segregated realms and saying like, oh, this is women's music or this is men's music or this is a woman's job and a men's job. And it just needs to kind of like blend together. So there's a new generation brought up with equal power in media or the workplace.
And now you have a radio show yourself, and you play mainly just women's music. So what do you have, a mission statement per se, or, you know, maybe goals with your show, and how do you find just women's music? Cause like you said, it's not very common. And especially with mainstream, how do you find, you know, the not so mainstream and the music to really get it out there?
Well, the radio station that I have my show at is all non-commercial music, so we receive tons of underground artists. And when I began working here a few years ago, there was tons of male artists that we get in here, and I'd play them on my show. And I realized that for me personally, it's not that it's not good music, I just don't relate to it as much as I do as female singers and songwriters. And so I just started really exploring our music library and learning about more artists and doing some research in different magazines and really finding out what I like. And I think it's discouraging because some people just don't even know what's out there because, you know, they listen to top 40 radio and they hear like just horrible examples of music and they're kind of brainwashed to think that that's all that there is, which is kind of discouraging. And so I just hope that with my show, I don't really have a mission statement, just to play a majority of female artists, that to get them out there, to have people think a little bit differently about music.
Thank you.
And that was from Brittany Perrault. She was talking with Brielle Schaefer, women's music radio show host, Daily Evergreen columnist, feminist, and shortly after that interview, a graduate of the WSU School of Communications. Installment number 5 features Christy Schwartz, and it's from the June 5th, 2007 Yin Radio program called Here Comes the Bride. This piece is Never Again, a Bridesmaid Story, or perhaps an alternate title, The Creamsicle Wedding.
Every picture has a story behind it. I was at my friend's house, Christy's, and I saw a picture on her tabletop. It was a group of young girls dressed alike, beautifully coiffed, makeup, hair, the works, and smiling like they shared a bond of orange dresses, no doubt, ones that cost too much and made them look like orange sherbet. Dresses that they would surely never wear again. Bridesmaids' dresses. What else?
Describe the dress, please.
Well, it was long. We spent probably 8 months looking for bridesmaids' dresses. And finally, we just saw one online and ordered them. So nobody had even tried it on. And mine was way too big, so I had the back seam sewn together. So first of all, because of that, it fit funny at the top. And so the straps, and they were big, thick straps, a couple inches wide over the shoulders, and they kept falling off. It was supposed to be kind of a tighter bodice, and then I don't even know the name of the skirt part, but it was loose and kind of floofy, but it wasn't like poofy or anything like that. And then it had a tie in the back, and it had a strip that came down. And in the picture, it was really pretty, and it was, I think the the name of the color was coral, but it looked like a creamsicle, and none of us looked good in it.
Was this a color the bride had chosen in advance?
Yeah, I was pretty relentless about that color. So there's only certain styles, and we ranged in all different sizes. I think the smallest size was like an 8, and the biggest was a 22. So, you know, I think what the bride wanted was a little summer dress, which wasn't going to look good on all of us. So. Just doing that dress was not a fun thing. I spent probably, close to $300 on the whole thing. That was how much money I spent on the stupid, really ugly dress and shoes that I'm never going to wear again.
And then it's important to understand Christy's situation when she took on this commitment of being a bridesmaid. Just out of school, a starving student, and this is one of three weddings she's agreed to be in, the first of three. She didn't have any idea, never could have guessed, probably, how the finances would figure into being a bridesmaid. And this was no cheap wedding.
I don't think she's especially wealthy, but her parents paid for all of it, and I just graduated college that May, and this wedding was in June. I hadn't even started working yet, so, you know, that was a lot of money for me, and for her, you know, I'm guessing she spent $20,000 or $30,000 on the whole wedding, but I don't think it was her money. So.
Still, that's
a house payment or a down payment for a house.
Big time.
Yeah. And then the bachelorette party. I haven't even told you about
that.
So my friend Sarah was going to throw like a little barbecue type thing. Mm-hmm. But that wasn't what the bride wanted. So the bride's mom ended up paying for us to go downtown Boise in a limo. And there was a woman there that like did all these different party things. So obviously she was hired, and if you won the little games, you got little shot glasses that you just drink. So those I'm sure weren't cheap either. Plus it was catered. There was food there, and we'd rented a coffee shop. Or we didn't, they did.
Yeah.
And then we went downtown and in a limo, and then we got driven home in a limo. It was kind of cool, but it was way over the top.
If the parents were throwing $20,000 to $30,000 at this wedding, it's easy to see that there was a different viewpoint from that of the independent student bridesmaids. First, there's the cost of the dress, then the gifts.
So there's a shower, there's a bachelorette party, there's a wedding gift, and a...
Well, and you're supposed to bring a shower gift and a bachelorette party gift.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And we also had to pay $20 to go to the bachelorette party.
Yeah.
And I didn't even get her a present. I put my name on the card from my parents.
Mm-hmm.
But I finally told her I couldn't afford to get my hair or my makeup done. So I was just going to do my hair myself and my makeup. And she finally, and she's like, well, if you don't want to do the wedding, just tell me. And I was like, well, I can't afford anymore. I'm not working, you know. And I should have just said, I don't want to do it. But I didn't. And so I don't remember if she paid, who paid for the hair. Maybe it was my mom, but it wasn't me.
Hmm. Oh, but and you did go ahead and have it professionally done.
Yeah. Yeah, she didn't want to do the the home thing. Same with I did finally just paint my nails because she wanted us all to get manicures and everything, and there's no way I could afford that, you know?
So Christy had a chance to opt out, but she didn't opt out. She came away with a creamsicle dress and a funny story. And she still has the photo, much to my surprise. But now the story doesn't seem as funny. It's a little sad, because the dresses aren't the whole story behind the creamsicle wedding photo. The story is the relationship between the bride and the bridesmaids.
Okay, so this was somebody who you would think, if you're going to spend this much money, this is a pretty close friend.
Yeah.
And she was a close friend?
Yeah, sort of. We were friends in high school. We'd been friends for a long time. I never really felt, I wouldn't say close to her, but maybe just because we'd known each other that long, we were supposed to be close by default. Mm. I don't know.
Do you think she felt
awful.
Close to you?
She might have.
Yeah.
I don't know.
And she's in touch now?
No.
I need you.
No. Sometimes I get cards, like Christmas cards, but they're not, nothing's written in them.
How long ago was this wedding?
It was summer of 2004.
So it's been a couple of years of Christmas cards and her being a married woman.
Yeah. And yet, nothing else. She moved to another state, and I really haven't. I think I saw her one time when she came home to visit her parents one time, but there was nothing to say. You know, those really awkward times when you're supposed to be happy to see each other, and it's just not there.
Mm-hmm. Well, why do you have the picture up? When you look at that picture, doesn't it get to you?
It's not up. I just haven't thrown it away yet.
Oh, okay.
And I don't know. It's just sitting on that front table with my other junk I need to clean up.
Maybe the creamsicle wedding was a giant, expensive, orange sherbet-colored celebration of a lonely young woman.
Yeah. Let's see. There's four bridesmaids. Three of us had gone to high school together. And then the other one was the sister of the groom. Mm. And her, I didn't know much. But in fact, one of the other bridesmaids said, I don't even know why I'm here. Because she'd come all the way from Kentucky. She'd gone to high school with us. And,
That's kind of sad.
Yeah, it is. But
she didn't even know why she was there? From what you've said, you're not 100% sure.
Yeah.
It was probably good she found three people who would show up.
Yeah, because I know a couple, the other two, were thinking about not doing it after certain points.
Yeah. Yeah, actually, when you've told me about it in the past, I felt the anger, and now it just feels kind of sad for her.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it is, because, in fact, this is horrible, but it's true. The one bridesmaid that said she wasn't sure why she was there saw another group of girls sitting at a different table, and she goes, oh, those must be the new friends, like, since high school. And I was like, I don't think so. I don't know who they are, but I don't think they're her friends. And I was like, I don't think she has new friends. I was like, why do you think we're here?
We're going to wrap up this Yin Radio collection with a song from Deirdre Flint. It's called The Bridesmaid's Dress Song.
My cousin Mary is a real good friend, so she's a bridesmaid for the 10th time. They say that love is blind, and a bride-to-be can prove it, 'cause what they pick for bridesmaids is a heinous fashion crime. She pays $300 for a dress the bride is claiming. If you hem it, you can wear it as a cocktail dress. Well, sure, if you hem it, redesign the sleeves, tear off the bows and rhinestones, tuck in the sash and dye it black, well then, $500 later, you will end up with a gown that is quite obviously a bridesmaid's dress, altered to be worn as a cocktail dress. Well, she called me when the dress came in and said, I can't believe it, but this one wins the prize for the most piteous. I said, you've got a wide-brim melon hat, nothing could be worse than that. But it was hideous. It was yards of silk and aqua, foamy green with lace and ribbons. It was scarlet crawling back up from the dead. And as she shoved her feet into a set of matching 4-inch heels, for lack of any better words, I said, someday jumbo white bows will be the rage, that's what my hunch is. And someday jade silk long gloves will be the power dress for corporate lunches. They brought the bell bottoms back. We said it couldn't be done. It's just a question of when. Don't trash that satin, I'm telling you, girl. You'll use that dress again. Reception was a dinner cruise that sailed into the bay. Despite the lace and ribbons, Mary looked divine. But another psycho bridesmaid who was jealous of her beauty lured her up onto the deck and pushed poor Mary into the brine. Well, she floated on for days because the bustle made her buoyant, and the sharks could not bite through the crinoline skirt. And her parasol turned over, caught her 10 fresh quarts of water, till she landed on the last uncharted island, weather-beaten but unhurt. She turned the rhinestone sunder, and the reflection made a fire, and the natives were impressed with what they saw. For they dined on wild bobcat, Mary caught with bow and arrow. She'd refashioned from the wire of her underwire bra. She said, hey, this jumbo butt bow will make a nifty rescue fly. And hey, this extra bustle I'll sew into a sleeping bag. I'll pay the natives fake pearls, they'll go and carve me a boat, and I'll be homeward again. I'm sure that this skirt will yield 3 full sails. Hey, I'm using this dress again. Well, a Miami plastic surgeon came upon Mary's distress note she'd sent floating out to sea in pillbox hat. And as Mary weighed anchor, he fell instantly in love, and he jumped into his private yacht and set to sail where he thought she'd be at. Well, a squall came from the south. The handsome surgeon's boat took water. He prepared himself to die amidst the wreck. But as his head was going under, he heard grab onto this butt bow, and our true love pulled him from the turgid water safely up onto her deck. They married 2 weeks later, and our Mary wrote a book, made 10 million on her video and tour. And these days when someone calls her at her mansion and says, hey, will you be my bridesmaid? Mary answers, sure, just dress me in 100.
You can listen to past shows of Yin Radio, and you can podcast this show or sign up for our electronic newsletter at yinradio.org. You can also find Yin Radio on MySpace and Facebook. Please drop us a line at yinradio@vpfound.org. That's yinradio at V as in voice, P as in power, found.org. Yin Radio is produced at KRFP, that's Radio Free Moscow in Moscow, Idaho, and it's heard on the best community radio stations in the country. This show is produced by Brittany Peralt and Sandy Billings. Opening music is Smell of the Sea by Piano Chocolate. Yin Radio is a production of VP Foundation. I'm Sandy Billings, the executive producer and host, and I'm glad you joined me.